Good morning, everyone. My name is Kathleen Newland. I direct the refugee programs here at the Migration Policy Institute. And I want to thank you all for coming and say how pleased we are to be presenting this report today. It is an overview of the refugee resettlement program in the United States with, I think, a very strong set of recommendations and observations about the program. It was undertaken by a team from the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia University, and we're delighted today to have three of them with us, and I think another will soon be joining us. Presenting the report is Kate Brick, and Kate is not only one of the authors of the report, but new employee of the Migration Policy Institute. So we're delighted to have her join us in wearing those two hats today. And we also have Alan Krill over on the side here, who'll be graduating from SEPA this coming year. He worked in the Philippines before that with the International Justice Mission, and also worked on human trafficking issues. And Megan Scanlon, another author of the report, finished with Kate at SEPA last year, and also has a Master of Science from the School of Social Work from Columbia, which, as you know, is one of the most distinguished in the country. And she also was in the Peace Corps before she started in Dominica. This is one of the remarkable things about this team of master's degree students from Columbia, that many, if not all of them, had prior and very relevant experience coming into this project. Samia El-Shafi, who I think will be joining us a bit later, who's another of the report's, was a legislative assistant to Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee before starting her master's, and also worked with refugee women in Cairo. So it's a team that knew a thing or two about the program before coming into this report, and I must say they did, in my view, a remarkable job of highlighting both the strengths and the weaknesses of the program. And we are extremely pleased to have them present it today. In doing the research and putting together this report, the team worked with the International Rescue Committee, and we're more than pleased to have our good colleague Bob Carey here with us today. He's the Vice President for Resettlement and Migration Policy at the International Rescue Committee in New York, and is also currently serving as the chair of the Refugee Council USA, which, as you know, is a coalition of the voluntary agencies that work in the resettlement program. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Kate Brick, who's going to take us through some of the highlights of the report. And then I'm looking forward to a lively discussion. We have a number of people in the room who are working or have worked with the refugee resettlement program, and can give us their views about the recommendations in this report. And we will also try to put it in, Bob will help us put it in context, and perhaps I will as well, of the broad set of deliberations that is going on in the executive branch, sort of rethinking the strengths and weaknesses of the refugee resettlement program. So, Kate, thank you very much, and thanks to Alan and Megan for joining us today. They'll join in the discussion afterwards.
Thank you very much, everyone, for being here. We have a very diverse group of people in the crowd, so I'm really looking forward to discussing what we found afterwards. As Kathleen mentioned, IRC commissioned the SEPA team to do a holistic outsider's perspective review of the refugee resettlement system and offer some recommendations for where there could be improvements. We are offering a macro system-wide set of recommendations, and we recognize that the subtleties of implementation would be best be addressed by the agencies themselves, which is another reason why it's great that so many people from those agencies are here today. Hopefully you have a copy of the report. If not, it's outside. I'm going to go through an order of the challenges and the recommendations as they are in the report, so feel free to follow along with me if you want to read in a little more detail than what I'm going to say today. The methodology for this report was desk research and interviews with high-level officials from the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, congressional staff, and then staff at the IRC and the IOM. And throughout the report, we used UNHCR-developed best practices for implementation as and for integration as our basis for setting recommendations within the U.S. context. Before going into the challenges we identified and some recommendations, I think it's really important to recognize the strengths of our program. The U.S. program is the largest refugee resettlement program in the world, as I'm sure you all know, and it has some very key attributes to it which could be bolstered and replicated in other areas as well. So first is the partnership that exists between government agencies and NGOs that take those U.S. government funds and implement them on the ground. This relationship is key because the funds are actually being utilized by people who know the day-to-day reality and know where they should best be distributed. Secondly is our plan for immediate reception of refugees. The U.S. does a really good job within the first 30 days of taking people in and making sure they're set up properly. That starts with someone meeting them at the airport and taking them to an apartment or a house that's already been set up with furniture and food and everything like that, and then really taking them through the first month of them being here, taking them to doctor's appointments, setting up social service appointments, starting them on language classes, employment training, things like that. We really do a good job those first initial 30 days. And from that, also, we have a very strong language program. In the first 90 days, it's required that refugees receive an interpreter, someone could speak to them in their native language, which is obviously critical when you're coming from a country that's very different from the United States. You may or may not speak English, and it's really nice to have someone to take you through the process in your own language as you're acclimating to being in a new country. And then lastly is the matching grant program, which we find to be a very strong program, and everyone we spoke to reflected that view as well. This is a program in which the Office for Refugee Resettlement will match funds that voluntary agencies can fundraise externally, and those funds are used towards refugee development, towards services and employment training and things like that, with the goal of having them gain self-sustainability faster because they have that added benefit. So in 2008, ORR provided $60 million for over 27,000 people, and job placement rate was in 120 to 180 days. That said, we definitely identified some challenges to the system, mainly just because the system hasn't really been addressed since it was first created in 1980 as a reactive system to the Vietnam War. And obviously, the context has changed significantly since then. We're resettling people from 60 countries around the world with very diverse backgrounds, very diverse needs. And so I think it's time that we take into account the reality of the refugee resettlement system today and looking at reforms. So in terms of overarching challenges, we identified four throughout the process, and those are conflicting policy goals, lack of adequate funding, obstacles to coordination and planning, and a lack of systematic monitoring and evaluation. We also identify challenges specific to the individual phases of resettlement. Those start with insufficient pre-departure orientation for admitted refugees, gaps in information and anticipatory planning during the placement phase, a lottery effect that occurs when the services that are provided to refugees vary depending on what community in what state that they're resettled in, a focus on quick employment once refugees are placed, and the fact that secondary migration isn't accounted for. So I'll go into each of these in a little more depth. In terms of conflicting policy goals between the PRM and the ORR, PRM is making refugee decisions in light of foreign policy goals, and with that, focusing on resettling the most vulnerable population in the world. ORR is coming from it from the perspective of social services and how to take care of these people once they're there. And there's a disconnect between the people that PRM is identifying that we resettle and the resources and management ability ORR and the VOLEGs have on the ground to actually resettle those people. And that speaks to the second major overarching challenge we found, which is just a lack of adequate funding across all levels. When we are resettling a group of such vulnerable, such diverse people, they require services and that reflect that depth and variety that with current levels of funding, it's really impossible to address throughout the country. Third are obstacles to coordination and planning, and this starts with the overseas processing entities when refugees are first processed before they come to the United States, through the government agencies and then to the voluntary agencies that actually resettle people on the ground. OPEs provide arrival projections to PRM, but this information is not shared with ORR or with the voluntary agencies responsible for resettling them. Also, the level of funding provided by ORR to voluntary agencies is based on previous years rather than the current flow or projections projections of future flows of refugees, so often there's a mismatch between the funds and the amount of people that are coming in. Lastly, there's a disconnect between the ceiling set by the president for the amount of refugees we're letting in and the ability and the capacity of ORR and voluntary agencies to actually resettle them. So what ends up happening is the ceiling is set higher than the amount of people we're actually taking into the country. So in 2006, we resettled 69% of the ceiling. In 2007, it was 97%. And in 2008, it was 86%. The last overarching challenge reflects the lack of systematic monitoring and evaluation of important measures of success that go beyond employment and job placement. No stakeholder is responsible for meaningful monitoring and evaluation of practices or outcomes for refugees or for the communities in which they're resettled, particularly over the medium and long term. And data collection is mostly confined to short-term outcomes that look specifically at employment within the first 120 days of arrival, which, when you think about it, for somebody coming here from a totally different country, is a very short period of time. That's not to say that monitoring isn't taking place at all. The PRM does routine audits and visits of different VOLAGs, and they actually speak with refugees as well as to what their experience has been. But this data are not regularly analyzed for differential outcomes for various refugee populations or for the community-level impacts. In terms of the phases, the first challenge we identified is just the lack of sufficient pre-departure orientation. Pre-departure orientation takes place before the refugees come here, and it's a cultural orientation that's supposed to give them a sense of what they can expect their life to be like when they arrive. Often this orientation takes place in a very short, consolidated period of time where they're overwhelmed with a lot of information that often they forget afterwards, according to the refugees that we spoke with. And another problem is that the people that are administering these orientations haven't necessarily been to the United States. In fact, most of them have not been to the United States. So sometimes there's an issue of misinformation, and people's expectations are totally off base. And when they get here, they're confronted with a situation that they had not anticipated at all. The second has to do with placement. There are gaps in information between the federal and local agencies, and that limits VOLAG's ability to make placement decisions about where it would be appropriate to place refugees. OPEs and PRM pass on only limited information to VOLAGs as to the background of the refugees that they're resettling. It's a very basic health record and other issues that really are surface level about each individual refugee that's coming in. And so when it comes to the VOLAGs to decide where these refugees should be placed and in what communities they should go, they're working off of very minimal information. Often the health information that is sent arrives too late. And so VOLAGs have had to already make that decision about where refugees should go without a full set of information as to the traumatic issues, health issues, disabilities, and other various attributes that these refugees have as they're coming in. Over the medium and long term are issues of services and support. There's a focus on quick employment, which makes sense, especially right now in our economy, that VOLAGs need to get refugees employed as quickly as possible so they can start paying their own bills and not rely on the public system to support them. Also, funding for VOLAGs often is within a certain time period. They have to get refugees into placement within the 4 to 6 months in order for them to receive those funds. The problem with this is that there isn't enough time to invest and develop the skills that refugees may already have. A lot of them come with higher education or specific skills to a certain industry, and those are overlooked and they end up being put in just the first job that comes available, which ends up dampening their ability to have social upward mobility in the future and dampens the long-term what would be beneficial outcomes if they had had more time to really invest in employment training. There's also a lottery effect that I mentioned earlier, which is created by the lack of uniform set services provided to refugees and the discrepancy in that, meaning that someone settled in one state is going to receive very different public benefits than someone settled in New York, for example, will receive a very different set and amount of public benefits than someone settled in California or Idaho or New Jersey. And in the same vein, VOLAGs have very different levels of funding and just ability to provide services as well. So it's really just luck of the draw where a refugee is placed in terms of the community they live in and the VOLAG that's resettling them in terms of how much is going to be available to them in terms of the resettlement process. The last challenge we identified is a very widespread one, and it has to do with secondary migration. Secondary migration is very common. It's when refugees end up moving to another locale after they've been resettled, usually because there's a stronger ethnic community there or it's known that there are more public services available. And the issue is that the money that's allocated to them when they first come in doesn't follow them into the new place. And so often what happens is the local communities there have to provide the necessary services for those refugees, the local government, as well as the VOLAGs, without receiving any compensation from the government. So that puts an added strain on their systems as well when the money is just left behind in the places that they left going unused. There are a number of challenges that we identified, but we found some recommendations through speaking with a number of people that we feel like are feasible. They're, as I mentioned, overarching, and so the subtleties of how they would be implemented, I leave it to the people in those agencies, and we'd be happy to discuss it further. But we would like to point out that no new legislation is needed to implement any of these recommendations. Changes within the system can be made by the director of ORR in consultation with the State Department, and so they wouldn't need to go through a legislative process, which makes it a lot easier. The first recommendation is budget allocation. We recommend that a study be commissioned that's a comprehensive analysis of the domestic resettlement system to determine what optimal levels of funding actually are. There hasn't been any kind of analysis of what a zero budget line would actually look like, so we would recommend that each stakeholder and agency do that analysis themselves and then submit it and have one giant proposed budget that would be necessary for the resettlement system to function properly and then have the federal government meet that budget. We also recommend that current activities that are aimed at aligning the federal budget request for resettlement program and the president's stated admission ceiling be aligned, because right now those two are set independently of one another, which doesn't really make sense. But right now there are activities to align those, and we recommend that, those actually take place as soon as possible. In terms of federal agency responsibilities, we believe the PRM should consult ORR about the capacity of the domestic service system prior to making any decisions about admission levels or target groups. ORR is much better positioned to assess the system's capabilities, and this would help ensure that actual refugee needs are given top priority while foreign policy goals are still considered. Third is information collection and information sharing. PRM should ensure that information collected overseas is passed on to receiving resettlement agencies. ORR, VOLAGs, and affiliates will be able to better adjust their services and prepare the receiving communities for the anticipated incoming refugee population. And it also will make it easier for them to match refugees with communities that are most appropriate for them based on their skills, based on their histories and the vulnerabilities that they might have. We also think it would be great to be able to consult refugees more as much as possible throughout this process. Often refugees have a place that they would like to go. They might have family there. There's a known community there. And while the VOLAGs do a very good job of matching people with their families, I think beyond families, really refugee preferences aren't taken into account. And we believe that they would be more productive over the long term and integrate better if their opinions were taken into account when it's determined where they go. We also think VOLAGs and local agencies should make projections about the needs and resources of the receiving communities as well and use that information to make proactive decisions. So not only should the refugees be going to a community that's going to help them, often communities have needs as well, and it would be great if those two needs were matched together and so a more fruitful relationship could be built. We also believe that there needs to be systematic tracking, monitoring, and evaluation of the system across the board. ORR and VOLAG should monitor and assess indicators other than employment. So this would include mobility, housing, education, health status, social connections, and language skills. Tracking outcomes should go beyond 180 days, and we believe that diversifying these indicators will allow for a more holistic picture that describes the varied circumstances that are occurring within refugees across the country and assessing how the integration is actually taking place. We also believe that the pre-departure orientation should be expanded. It should begin as soon as refugees find out that they will be resettled in the United States and take place beyond their placement and continue once they're already here. We also think that the information that's given in these orientations should be much more specific as to where they're actually going to be placed as soon as that knowledge is available, so they have a sense of not only they're going to the United States and what the American culture is, but this is the city you're going to be living in. This is what the layout of the city looks like. This is what public transportation is like, and that way when they get here it won't be such a shock for them and it might be easier for them to settle in. Following up on that secondary migration, we believe that secondary migration really needs to be accounted for and that the funds that are allocated to refugees follow them into the new place that they go. This is actually written into the refugee legislation of 1980. It accounts for secondary migration as a phenomenon, but right now there's just not the capability to allow that to happen. And so while it would require increased coordination between states and local agencies for those funds to follow them, given the possibility that refugees who migrate are traveling to locations where they have a stronger network of social support or increased likelihood of finding employment, we believe that the benefits outweigh the costs of coordinating that funds transfer. And lastly is meeting individual needs and creating long-term positive goals. This would include bolstering the matching grant program, which has been a very successful program, but would be better used if it were more widespread and affected more people. This would decrease refugee dependency on social welfare and also narrow the lottery effect. And then also expand employment services so they match the diverse needs of refugees that are coming in. This would include recertification programs, job-specific employment training, and extended language training. This would improve chances of long-term economic self-sufficiency and integration. So this is sort of a quick and dirty of all of our recommendations. They're obviously in much more detail in the report, but we look forward to your responses and a discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's, as you can tell, it's a really thoughtful report, and I'm sure many of you who are involved directly in this system will have thoughts about those recommendations. There's a lot to be said for having an external view of the program. And now we're going to turn to Bob Carey from the International Rescue Committee, who not only was involved in this report. I suppose you were sort of the client for this report, in a sense, Bob, along with the government agencies. So perhaps you could tell us a bit, put it in context for us.
Thank you, Kathleen. I think it would be helpful to just in context, very briefly, talk about the origins of the report. The SEPA program has what is known as a capstone program, which is. Generally, my colleagues here can talk about that in greater detail, but essentially, I wrote a proposal to Columbia of a project that could be undertaken by a group of students during their final time at Columbia, and which really requested a comprehensive overview of the U.S. resettlement program, which a number of our colleague agencies have undertaken, but really with rather limited resources and from very much an insider's perspective. So we really did think that this would benefit from a fresh external view, which would involve more resources and a broader research base, which fortunately Columbia seemed to think was a worthwhile project, and they were able to identify a number of students within their programs who had a considerable breadth of past experience in refugee and related social service work. So this is, I believe, very much the kind of project you would have paid a lot of money for in the private market. So certainly it's a pro bono benefit that the refugee program should certainly derive some of those, some considerable benefit from. I think it's also worth noting that this is data-driven, research-based. Even though I was a resource to this team, they very much drove their own process. My role and that of my colleagues at IRC was simply, for the most part, to provide background briefings and connect the team with other resources in the field. We were not giving direction as to the recommendations or outcomes. In fact, I had no idea what the outcomes were going to be until the final report came out. I was very happy to see what they were, but I was somewhat on pins and needles until I saw the final version. So I think that's important to keep in mind, that this was very much an independent report, data-driven, that the individuals who were engaged in it, a number of whom are fortunately here today, and were very much operating from a perspective of solid research and a comprehensive view of the program, and that those recommendations very much reflect that rather than the perspective of any one entity or sector in the refugee resettlement field. I'd also like to note that Kate spent her final semester, in addition to working on the report, also doing one-on-one work with refugees in New York. So had both the perspective of the national and international components of the program, but also the implications of those on the direct service to refugees and how these policies or actions translated into the services that refugees receive when they arrive to this country. So the report certainly was comprehensive. I'd also just like to further in context, this was an entire semester project, but I think that the team, I believe, devoted more than your average semester's worth of efforts to it based on the level of communication and data and the number of people and institutions that they brought into the process. I do think that this reflects the need for a larger view of the program, and having just returned, as some of my colleagues here in the room have done so also from both Geneva for the ATC, the tripartite consultations with other countries, and Tokyo, where another colleague and I were speaking about refugee issues with Japan and their emerging refugee program, it's clear that the implications for U.S. policy and the approach to resettlement are broader in a protection context than what the United States does. They very much can be a model for what other countries do. Certainly that was evident that Japan, as they're undertaking their pilot resettlement program, is very much looking at what are the best practices on the part of the U.S. and how can those translate into a program in Japan, as are other countries. Having said that, I think it's notable in the Geneva context, talking to other large resettlement countries or comparatively large resettlement countries, that their programs are in some aspects very much reflect the recommendations or some of the recommendations which are in this report. They tend to be much more data-driven. There is, if you look at either Canada, Australia, or even New Zealand or the Nordic countries, they have considerably more data on the refugees who are arriving and the outcomes on a longer-term basis than the United States currently gathers. The U.S. program is larger. That's a more significant undertaking, but certainly the stakes are larger as well because the numbers of people we're talking about serving and their needs are enormous. So I think the recommendations with regard to both data-driven information both overseas and in the United States and in the placement process are not only sound, but they reflect the decisions that some of our colleague nations have taken as well. Secondary migration, certainly that, you know, some of these issues that we see reflected very much echo what colleague agencies, HHS, state coordinators and others have seen as some of the critical problems in the program as it's currently structured, which have been exacerbated by the current economic downturn, particularly the more effective coordination. It's not solely an issue of resources, which I'm happy to see that the authors recognize, but also very much how those resources are directed and used and maximized, ensuring that information is available to receiving communities so that they can use whatever resources they have in a planned and effective fashion prior to a refugee's arrival, rather than in the current much more reactive mode when a refugee arrives and then there's a scramble to find the resources to meet the needs. Broadly, I won't go into the detail, I think that the recommendations really do provide a framework for both a study and some significant alterations in the current program, which would, I believe, significantly enhance both the use of resources and the quality of service to refugees in the United States.
Thank you very much. I would like to say just a word or two before we open the discussion about the process of rethinking the refugee admissions program and the arrangements for resettlement that is indeed underway in the U.S. government. It's taking place under the auspices of the National Security Council in the sort of humanitarian sort of part of the National Security Council, directed by Samantha Power, and Scott Busby of the NSC has really been the sort of principal director there, who has been overseeing this process. And Scott himself has a background at UNHCR and PRM in Geneva, overseeing one of the intergovernmental processes that tries to share information among, as it happens, the major resettlement countries, among others. And this review of the resettlement program has been, really involves all the federal agencies in the resettlement program, not just PRM and ORR, the agencies that are the focus of this report, the Department of Homeland Security, which is responsible for the sort of legal aspects of admissions, making sure that the that the refugees who are being admitted are indeed who they say they are and have a well-founded fear of persecution. And we're very fortunate today to have the officer from DHS, from Citizenship and Immigration Services, who oversees the refugee corps and the other parts of the other aspects of the program responsible for refugee admissions there, Barbara Strack. And I hope Barbara will give us her views at some point of some of these recommendations. But that NSC review has also engaged the voluntary agencies and many other non-governmental partners, including think tanks and academics who work on this subject, as well as the members of the Refugee Council USA. And I think it has been a very good listening exercise, and it's my impression that the NSC and the agencies involved have taken very seriously the feedback that they're hearing from the resettlement agencies. Some of the outcomes so far have been a sort of emergency infusion for housing of refugees, which helped a lot of families get through at least part of the economic downturn. I think that was a $5 million infusion that PRM found or sort of extracted from their overseas assistance. Unfortunately, the money has to come from somewhere, so there's an element of robbing Peter to pay Paul in this, but when you have a fixed budget, that's necessary. It has also resulted in a doubling of the reception and placement grant, the sort of per-head grant that the voluntary agencies get from the State Department. And it has resulted, I'm told, in more regular meetings and more communication among the agencies involved. And perhaps Barbara can tell us a little bit more about that process. So the executive branch is seized with the refugee resettlement program. Congress has always been involved with it and indeed has supported and pushed the program, even at times when the executive branch was sort of faltering in its determination to keep the flow moving through the system. And that's, I think, a very encouraging development that's going on now. So let me invite you to make your comments. And as I said, there are a number of people here. Anastasia Brown, who heads the Resettlement Committee at RCUSA. I saw Mark Hetfield from the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Larry Yunk, who directs the resettlement activities at the UNHCR office here, and many other experienced people. So please, I'd invite you to make your comments, and others of you may, please don't hesitate to make your comments as well and put your questions to Kate and Alan Krill, Samia El-Shafi, and Megan Scanlon. We have four of the six authors of the report with us today, and we invite them to also react to comments and questions. Could I ask you to introduce yourself as you begin to speak? Sure. Thank you.
Sharon McKay from Center for Applied Linguistics, and I'm curious about how many of the folks that you interviewed you needed to use translators for, and how language fit into the study as you were going, and how language fit into the outcomes?
Of the refugees that we spoke to, it was on a very informal basis. Usually I was just talking to people in the office that I was working in, and they all spoke English, or I spoke to them in Spanish. But generally the people that we conducted interviews with were with the agencies and stakeholders, and so the refugees we spoke with were a much smaller percentage of people we interviewed. However, they did indicate that language is a serious problem, and I saw that just within the New York Resettlement Office. They have on staff people who speak probably about five languages, but there always can be someone who speaks a language that someone doesn't necessarily speak, and it does pose a problem. There's understaffing as well. If you want someone, people would often come in and ask for someone to come with them to an appointment, so come with them to get food stamps or things like that, and there's a large volunteer population, especially within the IRC, and the IRC really runs on a lot of the volunteer work. But if there isn't someone there, then they have to go by themselves and manage that system on their own, and so language is a huge huge issue. And even though we do have this 90-day program, there can't always be someone with every single person at every single appointment. So it's critical.
Jack?
Jack Martin, FAIR. One short comment and one short question. The comment is that many of the recommendations seem to do with resources, and yet there's not really any discussion of resources. And I recognize that one of the recommendations is a study of resources. But it seems to me that is sort of prejudging the outcome to be talking about shortage of resources and then recommending that resources be studied. But the question is, because of the fact that some of that funding that is used for the refugee resettlement program is also spent on people who gain asylum, who have come to the United States on their own, would you suggest perhaps one of the things that might be an outcome of a study of funding would be to do a separation of funding, a dividing line between that money that is allocated for refugee resettlement and that money that is used because of people who have already come to the United States qualify on the basis of asylum, because of the fact that the number of asylum adjudications are rapidly increasing and therefore eating more into the refugee resettlement funding.
I don't know if one of the other authors want to answer that. Samia, did you want to answer that?
Would you just wait for the mic, Sammy? Thanks.
Hi.
this is Samia El-Shafi, whom I introduced you in your absence.
Yeah, sorry, I got lost in the circle.
Yeah.
Easy
to do.
New to D.C. I think that one of the important things to remember is that those that qualify for asylum are, in fact, refugees. And so they are going to need a lot of the services that we talk about. I think something else that's important to remember is that a lot of these recommendations don't necessarily require an increase in funding, but rather an increase in coordination, an increase in discussion, and a reallocation of funding that's already there.
Thank you.
I'd also just like to add on that, with the reason we had that as a separate recommendation was because we recognized as we were talking to various stakeholders that no one could give us a dream budget. So while we recognize there may be services that we recommend that should be added, but no one could tell us what that would cost. So we had to kind of put that in. We couldn't make up a number on our own, since we wanted to be data-driven ourselves. So that was a big reason for that separate recommendation.
Thanks. And then those difficult decisions that might have to be made about resources could be made in a more sort of rational way. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, this is Nikki Cicerani from Upwardly Global. Can somebody speak a little bit more to what the challenges are to better coordination if they're not directly linked to funding? And just be more explicit. I think I would benefit from knowing more about that.
Well, I think that there are many, and some of them are detailed in the report, but you know, one of them I think is structural, and I don't mean to, my view may be somewhat different from the authors of the program in this, and that there are a number of federal agencies involved in this program very capably, but there is no overarching authority. There's no individual or entity that has overall coordination as their role for this program. So in spite of many of the best efforts, and I think certainly it has improved, there are disconnects between information flow, as the authors of the report detailed, as well as resources, and ensuring that those are directed in a timely manner to the places where the needs are greatest for the current population. You know, the funding formulas at HHS, for instance, are retrospective. They currently look at what was the refugee flow to a given community 3 years back. And so that doesn't necessarily reflect, it does not reflect who's coming today and where they're going. The pattern of arrivals for refugees today is quite different. The populations are quite different. Iraqis weren't arriving to the U.S. 3 years ago. And as those of us who are involved in the program know, Iraqis are not going to the communities where prior populations went. So obviously there's a heavy impact on Detroit, Chicago, San Diego, for instance, and there may be, and I think that echoes throughout the program. So clearly there needs to be more effective coordination of where those people are going. And some, I know it's not easy to move the government ship quickly, but certainly there, I certainly believe it could be done to ensure that there are more advanced planning on where refugees are going to be going, what those needs are. We know, for instance, and I'll use the Iraqis as another example because it's one I know, that there's a high level of, it's a highly educated population, that there, as you well know with your organization, that there are considerable medical needs. So, you know, clearly the employment services for that population arguably are, and their needs are different than that of a non-English-speaking or even an uneducated population without professional skills. And if we're going to make maximum use of the talents that refugees bring here and have them become employed, tax-paying members of their communities as quickly as possible, it's a worthwhile investment to ensure that those resources are directed where they're going to reap the most benefit, so that you don't have surge English-speaking surgeons working in a McDonald's when we have a shortage of skilled medical personnel in this country. They may not be able to work as surgeons, but there are certainly capacities in which they could work, as an example, which would benefit them and their receiving communities much more significantly than the current system allows or facilitates.
Thanks, Bob. Before we go to the next question, I'd like to see if there are any comments on this question of coordination from, yes, Anastasia. Yeah.
Hello, Anastasia Brown with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and Chair of Resettlement Committee for the RCUSA. One of the very interesting things about coordination in this program is the planning cycles. Each, as Bob said, you have very different agencies. Each one of the agencies, federal agencies, is on a different planning cycle. The states which receive refugees, the state funding cycles don't match the funding cycles of the federal government necessarily. The voluntary agencies planning for resettlement, we've just gone through this process right now in June, before we know what the numbers may be, before we know the populations, is not done in necessarily matching cycle with what the state is planning for. So coordination of just that type of resource would be immensely helpful.
Thank you very much, Anastasia. Let's go to Don.
Yeah, Don Kerwin of Migration Policy Institute. I had a question taking off on the issue of the diversity of the refugee population and how it hasn't really changed since 1980 in significant ways. And the question goes to whether self-sufficiency is still the right goal, you know? And if so, is it the right goal for everybody? And if not, you know, what is the right goal or set of goals at this point?
Megan?
I think that in the report, certainly this is reflected more if you read it, that we were definitely trying to expand. That was one of the reasons we said to take off that employment, that focus on quick employment, was that self-sufficiency and integration are sort of stated goals of the program. And already integration is pretty much ignored in any of the outcomes that are tracked, which we find problematic. And in addition, the self-sufficiency is tracked very narrowly. So we definitely did see a need to broaden the outcomes that were tracked in those regards. Part of the problem, of course, is sort of operationalizing those particular benchmarks. So that was one thing we didn't go into as much as we would have liked in the report, but we definitely saw a need for that process to happen.
Just to follow up on that, we had a debate within our group as to how we would define self-sufficiency, and the definition we used wasn't the one that we would have used. And it goes back to what we were saying about what outcomes you track, and also in terms of what the goals are, it's not just the refugee, but it's a community as a whole. We would hope that the refugees are benefiting, the communities are benefiting from those refugees, that they are able to contribute to the maximum of their ability, and often they aren't. Just as we mentioned, people who are so overqualified, surgeons working as taxi drivers and whatever. There's so many different examples and anecdotes you can use. But it's not just about them being able to pay their bills on time. And it's really about a community effect and them being able to contribute back into the community that they're living in and the community contributing to their experience in the United States as well.
Thanks. I think it's important to understand that Don's question is put in the context of a sort of shift in the emphasis of the program toward the most vulnerable refugees, and that you know that's quite a different population in part than the population which was defined more on sort of geographical and political terms of the early days of the refugee program. And, you know, when you have an elderly Iraqi widow with diabetes and high blood pressure and so on, you know, to the goal of self-sufficiency is clearly going to be somewhat compromised. More than somewhat. So I think that's a very, very good question that this review of the program at the NSC level should be considering.
Can I just add, Kathleen?
Please.
You know, I think I was struck, once again, talking to, of all people, the Canadians a couple of weeks ago and in Geneva, and to look at how their program is very much data-driven. They look, okay, they have academic partnerships, and I'm all for academic partnerships, because they really are looking 1, 2, 3 years out, multi-generational. What are the... what are the economic benchmarks for refugees? You know, the U.S. program is very much looking at what happens in the first 90 days, which is a very short window. And, you know, the Canadians, as an example, and I don't think the Canadians are alone in that, are looking at what are the things that can be done during the initial period which are going to have significant impact a year, 2 years, or farther out on the economic condition, not only of the refugees themselves, but of the communities that they're going into. They have even, you know, engaged in some multi-generational studies, so they know, you know, what are the critical programming initiatives that you would do in the initial year that are going to do much more to ensure that the next generation, those who are going to school, are graduating from college, are, you know, so that's driving their programming, and I think it's, and they're certainly seeing the fruit of that approach in high rates of academic achievement among the refugee children, which we do have in the U.S., but we know that only anecdotally. And we certainly, I believe subjectively, that, you know, after-school programs, which organizations like IRC run largely with volunteers, play a critical role in ensuring that children play in school, stay in school, integrate, graduate, become contributing members of the society. But those are available in the U.S. on very much a piecemeal basis. But what we know, the Canadians actually can demonstrate, okay, this is what the economic benefits of this kind of programming are, and it makes it much easier to ensure funds are directed to those areas. So it's a call for academic and think tank partnerships in the refugee program, which I'm sure Kathleen won't disagree with.
No, we're all for that, and indeed do a lot of work on integration here and on multi-generational issues. Okay, I have a number of hands going up now. Lisa, maybe you could start back here in the corner. Well, yes. Thank you. Then we'll go to Larry.
Good morning. Ruben Chandrasekhar from the International Rescue Committee. I'd just like to add a comment about the whole issue of community integration and how there isn't really much funding in the refugee resettlement process for it. And there isn't really a broad vision of what it means, I think. And one of the problems that I see is that there isn't really any kind of a vision for building good partnerships locally where refugees are being resettled beyond partnerships with service providers, you know, employment service providers, social service providers, health service providers, and so on. And I think that creates a lot of potential conflict and actual conflict when people are basically put into these communities that have no idea of who are the new arrivals, right? And we see a huge amount of violence because of misunderstanding on the streets, hate crimes and things of that nature. And people just don't know how to build that relationship, and the Volags don't have the capacity to do so. So I just like to add that the importance of having that broader vision of community integration that includes local partners like community associations and local leadership.
Thank you. I think that's a very important point, Ruben, and sort of speaks to the, in a way, the sort of decline of community involvement in the refugee resettlement process, which was a very strong feature of it in the early days, and perhaps in the necessary and laudable drive to professionalize the program, there's also been sort of a turning away from that really deep community involvement through, as you say, community centers, congregations, and whatnot. Larry?
Yeah. Larry Young from UNHCR. I was struck going back to the question about coordination and of setting goals and objectives and indicators, et cetera. And I think one of the things that those have been involved in some of these discussions wrestle with is where's that point where they're, and saying as somewhat of an outsider for UNHCR, what is the U.S. goal in resettlement, not just the individual departments that run the program? And one question I would put, to what extent, and maybe to the researchers or to Bob, to what extent I think the consultation process that was established in the Refugee Act was seen as some point of coordination annually, and is it being used to sort of set cross-cutting goals and objectives that could then cascade down to the various partners that are playing? I think it continues to be reflected that each agency has a set of goals. I think the report indicates that they work under, that's maybe more informed by their parent departments than necessarily the U.S. refugee program. And that makes it difficult, I think, for those who are looking at the program to know exactly, you know, what the program's trying to achieve. And it also makes it difficult then to lay out what the objectives and goals of the entire program are, because presumably you want to measure the overall outcome and not just the outcome of DHS or PRM or the states and such. But my question basically is, to what extent do you think the consultation process and the report to Congress annually, et cetera, might be a vehicle for greater coordination of the program?
Samia?
Well, I think it's important to remember that in the text of the Act itself, it requires that the stakeholders meet no less than quarterly. So, I mean, we had, some access to information issues. Not everyone was as forthcoming with how often they meet. I think that something that's really important when you bring up USRAP is that, you know, when we were talking, we had the privilege of talking with someone at IOM, and she was focusing on how they really see themselves as just focusing on getting the refugees here. And so not so much each agency is kind of concerned the most with what phase of the process they're dealing with. So I think it is really important that we kind of define what is it that we want out of this system, and that, you know, in these meetings, we discuss how each stakeholder, how each agency can really work together to achieve those goals.
Thanks. I think that points to the importance of the fact that it's the National Security Council that's leading this sort of review of the program, because it's the only sort of location where there isn't a particular sort of departmental focus. Yeah.
I'm Jessica Owens. I'm with Senator Schumer's office right now. And just in terms of the consultation process and the role of Congress in the consultation process, we very much welcome input from all of you, your expertise, as we prepare for the consultation, which probably will be in September of this year. And to the extent that the senators and Congress people that are involved in the process can influence the decisions made by the agencies, we definitely seek to do that and really welcome your input. So we look forward to hearing more from you as the consultation nears for this year.
Thank you, Jessica. Be careful what you wish for, you. I think that is a very important point, and Congress, after all, has the power of the purse for this program as for all others. So it's I think those consultations are critical. Do any of the rest of you involved in that program, involved in any of the agencies, want to comment on this coordination or communication issue? Okay. I see your hand, but I've seen some others over here first. Could we go to Jesse Bernstein on the aisle, please?
Hi, Jesse Bernstein, Human Rights First. I just had a question speaking about the most vulnerable and how the program has shifted. One of your points is information collected and shared by PRM and the OPEs to the VOLAGs here. And I just wonder if you could talk in more detail about that and where you see the primary problems, how information could be shared in a more detailed way. I think many of us know about the allocations process where information actually is shared. So what's not working? And how can it be improved?
I'll let the other authors comment on this as well, but just the information that's collected abroad, especially in terms of health profiles and things like that, are for the purpose of determining admissibility. So they really don't get into the details of what a person's personal history is and how that would be relevant to once they're resettled in the United States. So that's the first step, is actually collecting more relevant information than beyond just the sort of ticking off of boxes of whether or not this person is healthy enough to come and things like that. And then secondly, it's sharing that information in a more timely fashion. The information that comes from abroad, as I mentioned, gets there often too late to influence the placement decisions at these round robins that VOLAGs have when they are deciding where refugees should go. So not only is it the quality and the quantity of their information, but it's actually having it in time to utilize it in a way that's going to help them match refugees with the communities that will be beneficial both to the refugees and the communities themselves. I don't know if any of you want to add more to the details of that process.
Okay. I'd like to hear from Barbara and Anastasia and Bob, all of whom are deeply involved in the allocations and pre-departure.
Thanks, excuse me. Thanks, Kathleen. As you know, I work with DHS, and most of the recommendations in the report are much more focused on the PRM and ORR aspects of what happens once refugees are here. So I don't want to address those directly, but I did want to mention on this information sharing, it struck me that there may be some internal tensions in the report between different aspects of the recommendations, in particularly the recommendation for an increased sort of refugee-centric approach and refugees having a greater voice in the program. Excuse me. But two places where I thought there might be some tension with that is, one, the sharing of information, because we in DHS take the confidentiality of the refugee interview and really all of the information we gather extremely seriously. And so it seems to me, in particular with respect, you know, perhaps what language you speak and what language services you need is not such a personal confidential issue. But it seems to me collecting medical information and sharing medical information on refugees, in contrast, is a very kind of profound thing. And I was just wondering how you may have grappled with that issue. And similarly, with respect to your recommendations on cultural orientation, again, as you know, right now that's voluntary. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if in recommending enhanced cultural orientation, you would also recommend that it be mandatory. For encamped refugees, the delivery of that is relatively less complicated. But as you know, as the program is moving more to urban and dispersed refugees, delivery of cultural orientation is made more complex by that profile as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. If you don't mind, Barbara, just let's hold that question for a moment and have the other comments on this.
On the issue of information sharing, there is the issue of individual refugee information, which is a lot of this concentrated on, but also trends. So as an example, in preparing for planning for refugees, if we know that a certain percentage of these refugees have had a certain history, without necessarily saying this particular refugee has, it helps in the planning cycle to know we have to be prepared that in this group of refugees, we're going to see a certain percentage of women who have been subjected to violence, as an example. That type of information sharing is really needed far in advance of the individual information which is needed for the individual placement. that is a lacking component of the system, or it's not always, it's sort of hit and miss. Sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't. Just as an example of medical information and the difference, refugees do in fact sign a release saying that the agencies that information will be shared with the agencies that are going to be assisting them. But we concentrate, as was noted, on excludable medical conditions and also what is evident from what the refugee told you, so it's not necessarily screened for. And I have had recently two cases of young children placed in a high altitude where they're dying because they have sickle cell complications. So this is not necessarily something screened for or reported unless, so I have to move them. This is just a sort of immediate example of why it's important.
Very compelling one, too. Bob, did you want to?
No, I was actually going to mention what Anastasia does. There is a waiver process, and obviously it needs to be treated discreetly, but there's already a considerable amount of information that refugees are waiving their unlimited basis that can be passed on. The question is, we do know from those of us who've been involved in refugee screening overseas, there's a lot of data that goes into the system on the receiving end from OPEs, which doesn't come out on the other end. It's gathered for purposes of admissibility or others, but it certainly has relevance to placement decisions and other aspects of the resettlement process. Certainly, we also know that there's profile data more broadly that UNHCR gathers when they're looking at a specific group population, and currently that's not translating through to the receiving communities either. And I know this has been under discussion with the NSC as part of that process, but certainly there's a lot of data out there, and you can get overwhelmed with data, but there is data that could be used to better prepare receiving communities for the U.S. And having said that, I think, regrettably, having been in this program for quite a few years, I do remember 20 or so years ago when there was a much freer flow of information between the OPEs and the receiving communities. I know that had complications, but it also meant that there was a lot of information flow around individual cases and their needs. But I think that was also, for better or worse, when most of the OPEs were run by organizations that also did resettlement in the U.S., so institutionally we're much more aware of what the implications of a given medical condition would be in a receiving community. And I think with a move to increasingly using IOM or other contractors, I think that's and a less casework-driven approach, that's even among the OPEs that are resettlement agencies, it's that information flow has in fact been hindered. And I think that's we've actually seen a deterioration in the quality of information that goes to receiving communities than what was the case 20 or 25 years ago.
Very interesting. On the second row here, I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
I'm Martin Ford from the Maryland Resettlement Program. I have a suggestion and two quick comments. Mm-hmm. The suggestion has to do with your first recommendation, determining funding levels. Refugee resettlement is always described as a public-private partnership, but I've never once seen it stated what should be the contribution of the public sector and the private sector. It's never been quantified as far as I know. And that suggestion might start with, or that study might start with doing that. I'd also like to comment on the diversity of the program and the self-sufficiency mandate. When I started back in 1992, resettlement in my state, in fact, in the nation as a whole, was primarily Southeast Asian and former Soviet. In Maryland, the best resettlement I've ever seen nationally was done in Baltimore's Jewish community for former Soviets. It was a homogeneous community. The refugees, relatively, fairly well educated, in some cases very well educated, with incredible private support. The community really coming to bat for these refugees. And we later did a study on their success, and it was remarkable. A third of the families had incomes of $100,000 or more. Now, in the past 5 years, we've resettled refugees from 82 different countries. You mentioned that Iraqi widow with diabetes. We were talking about her yesterday. She has 7 children, 4 of whom seem to have post-traumatic stress syndrome because they saw their father shot. The self-sufficiency mandate that we've got is impractical for a lot of these cases. And yet the alternative, after the 8 months, if the employable refugees don't have jobs, then they're turned over to a social services program that has sharp edges for the native-born American, let alone for the refugee who doesn't speak English, doesn't know the culture. The mainstream program doesn't know the culture, doesn't know the language. And I used to think of myself as sort of a facilitator of the American dream. In recent years, I sometimes think I'm a contributor to, permanent underclass in some cases. Most of the people we deal with are making it, but there's a significant minority who aren't. So your recommendations, I hope many of them are acted upon.
Thank you very much, Martin. I'm very, very glad you made that comment. And I think, as this federal government review and rethink of the program goes on, that perhaps it's incumbent on the voluntary sector or the NGO sector to do their own sort of comprehensive review of the program. And as it comes back a bit to an earlier question about how do we encourage the private community groups and so on to be more involved in this process as they used to be? I think that's absolutely critical. The trouble with voluntary programs is that they're voluntary, and so you can't have you can't demand that of a community. But I think we can certainly do a lot more thinking about how to encourage it. And I apologize, I didn't give the team the chance to respond to Barbara's question about the tensions that might be might appear to take place between some of your recommendations. Would you? Do you want to start, Kate, and then we'll come to...
Okay. I mean, I think that actually that question was addressed in the comments from Bob and from Anastasia as well, in that there is a... refugees do sign this release for the information, and it has to do also with acknowledging the trends that exist, so not necessarily each individual person. But also just to get back to your question about cultural orientation, I think, and I'd be interested to hear others' views on this who actually work abroad, but I think that it should be mandatory, actually, and obviously it's much easier when you're in refugee camps because you have a captive audience. It's much more difficult when you're working in an urban environment, but I think that to some extent it's irresponsible to send people here without them having any knowledge of what they can expect once they get here. I mean, it's pretty traumatic anyway, and I think that it needs to be ensured that there is at least some level of orientation before they get here. So that would be my personal response, but I'm sure others see it differently.
Before I give it to Samia to speak again to the orientation issue, coming from a social services background and a social work background, in terms of the confidentiality, I just want to emphasize, I think it's been said, but if someone's signing a waiver and is agreeing to pass on this information, it would be a simple matter of saying, we're going to pass this then on to the next person in the chain without breaking confidence. You know, that would not then break someone's confidence or confidentiality. So I guess... So as someone who takes it very, very seriously and the work background that I have, I don't see it as in any way an insurmountable issue. It's a very simple matter to resolve, I would say.
Hi, I just wanted to speak more to the orientation issue. As you know, there's also, it's kind of a two-part orientation. It's not just a cultural orientation, and we were actually hoping to kind of expand the orientation process as a whole. The average orientation, pre-departure orientation, now lasts between 5 to 25 hours per refugee. The information they get, as Kate has talked about earlier, often inaccurate. And, I mean, from refugees who are here now, it's interesting the feedback we got. Some said that the expectations they had coming in were unrealistic, while others said they were scared to death. So there's kind of a disconnect in what kind of information is being shared. But also just the fact that just the information that the refugee needs to get safely from where they're leaving to the United States. I had a kind of heartbreaking experience with an Iraqi refugee earlier this year where he had had to change planes 5 times. And luckily, I speak Arabic. So, I mean, he didn't know. He had his IOM bag, but he didn't know quite what to do with it. And he didn't have his little info card out. And it's, as far as he was concerned, he wasn't aware that he was supposed to take that sheet of paper that I don't know if you guys are all familiar with the IOM card the refugees have when they're traveling. And it says, you know, their name, this is a number you can call in an emergency, this is their flights, whatever. And, you know, he didn't know that he was supposed to show that card, nor did he know that someone was going to be picking him up at the airport. Nor did he know, you know, we were in Minneapolis. His final destination was Sacramento. He didn't know if he was supposed to leave the airport or not. You know, these are things that need to be addressed before refugees leave. They need to understand what that process is, and maybe 5 hours right before you leave is not the time to do that, especially when we're talking about refugees who are in camps. As Kate said, you have a captive audience. And another suggestion that was made to us was having English language training start there. Because you have people who could be there for years, you know, so, you know, really utilizing that time as much as possible.
Okay. Could we go to the gentleman in the second row there and then the lady? Oh, okay. This is a comment rather than a question, so thank you.
Okay, thanks. Hi, I'm Colleen Maher-Piersma from the Cultural Orientation Resource Center at the Center for Applied Linguistics, and so we're PRM and OR's Technical Assistance Provider on Orientation. Just a couple comments on the things. One is that our guidance or our instructions from PRM, what we understand from them, is that as a humanitarian program, they don't want to stop anyone from getting on the plane and making their way to a new life that's expected to be safer for them. Lots of other opportunities as well, but of course the first concern is their safety, and so that is why we understand that it is not mandatory. Mm-hmm. In terms of what people glean from orientation, it's correct that people receive between 5 to 25 hours. My colleague and I did an exercise recently at a conference where we had a couple people stand up in the front and a couple people in the room give information. One person said, you need to get a job right away because you're going to get evicted. And another person said, it's very difficult to find a job, but we can help you and you can do it. Then we asked the people in the front, what did you hear? And one person said, I remember the positive message. And one person said, I remember the negative one. So we have to keep in mind that what refugees come with and what they say isn't necessarily, it's everything is filtered. Everything is filtered by where you are, your expectations, your experiences, what other refugees are telling you, what you hear when you arrive here, and who you are as a person. We are, of course, working on trying to standardize and improve information that people receive overseas as well as domestically, which is the second half of that orientation. So right now, PRM has asked us to engage in an outcomes and indicators project. We're working on that with representatives from this different cultural We have a cultural orientation working group with representatives from PRM, ORR, the different voluntary agencies, overseas cultural orientation providers, and representatives from local resettlement affiliates. So what we're looking at right now is what people feel refugees should have learned or should know or have an attitude about when they arrive. What would be most helpful to them, their adjustment, and their integration? We've surveyed the overseas agencies. We're doing focus groups with refugees from Bhutanese, Iraqi, Burmese, and different African communities. We've had domestic affiliates submit information. And so this is an ongoing process. We've been working on it 6 to 8 months or so, and we hope to have something for the refugee admissions workshop that will be happening in late November or early December this coming year.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that information. That's a sort of preemptive response to one of the major recommendations here, and it's very encouraging.
Thank you. Khalil Abdullah, New America Media. I kind of stumbled upon the refugee issue and doing a report some years ago on African immigrants to the United States and where they ended up, and I was trying to figure out how Sudanese ended up, you know, in the top 5 population of Idaho. So that kind of informs, as a complete outsider to this very arcane universe. But do states have a structural role in the decision to settle refugees, or is this purely federal? And I'm asking this before the advent of the decrease in the tax base, just mm-hmm. as a matter of policy. And the second question is, on the federal side, because of the work we do with immigrant populations, we're seeing aging refugees. And so I'm wondering whether the Office on Aging is in also in any way involved in the decision and a consultation. Thank you.
Two very good questions. Thank you very much. Who wants to take the states, role of the states? Martin, yes, you would be a logical person to answer that question. It's a very lively one.
I'm not sure what you mean by a structural role. Do we have an input in terms of who's resettled in our?
I'm assuming from what I've heard that it's just the federal decision, but states have input, or do states actually are part of the policy written into the law, I guess?
We're part of the process. I think the VOLAG representatives can speak to the allocation among their different affiliates, but the way it works at the local level is we work with affiliates of different resettlement agencies within Maryland, and they determine in consultation with their headquarters how many refugees they'll settle for the coming year, and they'll speak to us about that and get our input, get our feedback. They will also be speaking with their national headquarters in terms of the national allocation, the division of the refugees among different states. So, yeah, I think it's a strong consultation, right?
And just to add to that, again, this is part of our planning process, so we are expected and Department of State expects us to make sure that consultation happens with all of our local affiliates and the state coordinator. But we don't actually have the details yet on who's coming, so we're making projections, assuming certain things, and that's always, you know, part of the tension. It's not an individual refugee. It has to be approved by every state. So,
and does anyone know whether the Office of Aging, Office on Aging in HHS is involved?
No, I think it would be helpful. A group of representatives from the resettlement agencies recently had a meeting with both ORR and Secretary Sebelius. And one of the outcomes from that meeting was, which has been something that the current leadership within the Office of Refugee Resettlement at HHS has been trying to advance, but which Secretary Sebelius has offered to have her office further, is making better, stronger connections with other federal agencies that have programs that are, whether it's the Department of Labor, where there are programs that refugees may be accessing now or may not be, but which they are eligible for, and just ensuring that there's more effective coordination, whether it's the Department of Aging or other federal agencies, that there is currently not active coordination between the refugee sector and those other federal agencies, whether it's HUD or, you know, any one of the number of other federal agencies that refugees will be coming into the center of or on the, you know, periphery of their programs.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we are rapidly running out of time, and I see several more hands. Let's take all these questions. Let's start it up in this row. Yeah, and yes, Joe, go ahead, and then the gentleman one off from you.
Yes, my name is Joe Cudahy. I've retired as the director of Refugee, Asylum, and International Affairs in U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And since my retirement, I've been an individual member of Refugee Council USA. And, Kate, I wanted to ask a question about the – first of all, I want to commend you for the report and commend you for starting out by listing strengths of programs. In my time as a federal employee, I can't remember very many reports that hit my desk that started out that way. Maybe that's because there were no strengths in things that I was doing. But the question that I had is, you mentioned the need for a data-driven set of information and suggested that PRM does some interviews post-arrival now, both with organizations and individual refugees. My recollection of that is dated. But I was always under the impression that the purpose of those, from PRM's perspective, was sort of a fiscal responsibility sort of activity. to make sure that the minimum requirements of the funding that was being provided were being met. Has that changed? My first question is, has that changed? My second question is, if it hasn't, are you suggesting that PRM should be the agency to expand that responsibility to start to gain the kind of information that you're talking about in this regard?
Okay, thanks, Joe. Let's take note of these questions, and then we'll come to them at the end. Yeah.
Thanks. Hi. My name is Timothy Vanderveeken, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. There was a lot of discussion about the coordination of information. And in terms of placement, I was wondering if you had any recommendations for priorities in placement, if refugees should be resettled in like communities or based on their employment history, or what your recommendations would be along those lines.
Okay, thank you. And then Lisa to the back, the gentleman standing there.
Yes, I'm Tessie Ajal. I'm with ECDC. And my question is about refugee communities, what we do to actually prepare community stakeholders and especially law enforcement from the perspective of receptivity and prevention of crime on these communities. Over the years, I'm sure you could recall incidents in places like Lewiston, Maine, Boise, Idaho, where we have to put out the fire of different types of conflict with key community stakeholders and mainstream community members and refugees. And this, I think, is largely because I don't know that we did enough to prepare these communities that these individuals are people that need help and not people that have seen enough, you know, of that kind of a treatment so that we can prevent them from going through that. Maybe Martin can help us with this. I don't know what states do with law enforcement and key community stakeholders to prepare people before refugees get settled. And maybe we can do a better job at that.
Thank you for that very, very thoughtful comment. And lastly, Peggy?
I think somebody said...
Introduce yourself, Peggy.
Linda Rabin. I think somebody said that some of the changes suggested could be made by the agencies without any change in the law. And I think that's very debatable. Could someone speak to the Refugee Protection Act? And is it thought that that could be an effective way of addressing reform?
Thank you, Linda. Okay, I'm going to give time for some very quick responses to that. I'm afraid that we are out of time, so we'd like to start. We have a question on the need for data-driven policies, priorities, and placement. Preparing communities to receive refugees and the Act. So
all very important questions. Just to respond to your question about PRM and the audits that they do, I agree. I don't think the policy has necessarily changed, and I think that the interviews that they do are driven to account for the money that they're spending. But I do think, yes, they would be a great place to start. I think that all of the agencies should actually do that kind of review that goes beyond meeting what they're just accounting for the money that they're spending. But PRM in particular, because PRM is developing policy, so I think it's more important for them to really understand what is going on the ground. And just speaking to people that I know who work for PRM who actually conduct those interviews, I know that the interviews themselves involve a lot more. The content involves more than just is this happening the way it should, and it really goes into personal experience. But the extent to which that information is then shot up the chain in the review process itself, I'm not sure. To speak to placement priorities, I think VOLAG's people here from the VOLAG community would probably do a better job of saying what they would be. But just to sort of segue into the question of community receptivity, I think one of the priorities should be that, and it's hard when you have so many people you're trying to place in communities across the country, some which could be receptive and some which aren't. You don't really get to choose based on receptivity. But if there was more of an emphasis put on communities that could use refugees and some kind of analysis done on where are places in the country that could use the skills that refugees might bring, and an example of this is Utica, New York, where the economy of Utica, New York was completely revitalized by a refugee community that came in starting in the 70s and is still a very strong flow today. And Utica was declining. I mean, they were going to have to shut down businesses, houses were being condemned, and because this refugee influx came in, the city is now completely revitalized. It's one example, and obviously it's specific to the economy of that community, but that's not to say that there aren't other country or cities and communities around the country where that would be the case as well, and we just don't know about them. And if we had that information, think about how much more beneficial it would be to put refugees in that place where not only does the community want them, which creates a better environment for receptivity, but it also helps them get jobs that perhaps will help them be more socially mobile.
I could speak really quick to the legality issues. Within the text of the Refugee Act of 1980, it specifically states that the director of ORR has the authority over policies and strategies for the placement and resettlement of refugees within the U.S. As such, any component can be altered by the director in consultation with the Department of State. And that is explicitly stated within the legislation section 411.2, C sections 2 through 3.
Okay, thanks. Bob, final word?
Yes, I just may want to make reference to some of the pending legislation. I think certainly, you know, from our reading of the Refugee Act, the authority exists. The question is, has that authority been exercised? And does it require some more legislative authority or incentive to do so? And I think certainly the argument can be made, since the authority is not currently being exercised, that a legislative framework which enhances that has considerable value. I think there's also concern that even if the actors in a given administration do choose to exercise the authority that exists under the Refugee Act, that people come and go, administrations come and go, and that you try to institutionalize a framework that that recognizes the need for enhanced coordination would be certainly welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you all very much. I've heard a number of really important messages from the report being sort of amplified in this discussion, one about the need for information, one about the need for greater coordination among agencies, the importance of a long-term perspective beyond those first 90 days, and I think perhaps most importantly, working with government and private agencies working to find that balance between early self-sufficiency and the danger of dependency. And getting that balance right is obviously critical for the population that we have. Please join me in thanking Kate and Alan and Megan and Samia for their terrific work on this report, and Bob Carey for his comments.
For more information on MPI's Refugee Protection Program, please visit migrationpolicy.org/research/refugee.